You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of December 2015 on Monocle 24.
Welcome to Midori House. We're coming to you live from Studio One. This is Emma Nelson. On today's show, the British Parliament wrestles with extending airstrikes over Syria. My guests, Tim Marshall and Daniela Pellard, will tell us what they think of 6 hours of debate and what any result could mean for the campaign against IS, or Daesh, as the Commons have now chosen to call them. Also ahead, Russia claims it can prove Turkey's buying oil from the terrorists. We'll discuss the latest chapter in a diplomatic mess. Plus, the bastion of the German weekly Der Spiegel cuts its staff and puts up a paywall. If they're having trouble, what must it be like for everybody else? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. So welcome to Midori House, my guests today, Tim Marshall and Daniela Pellard. As we go to air, the parliamentary debate over extending British military airstrikes over Syria is entering its seventh hour. The debate has made for intense watching. Hearts as well as minds are being very openly exercised in the Commons chamber. This is what the Prime Minister David Cameron had to say as he set out his pro-strikes position, followed immediately by the opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn.
This is not 2003. We must not use past mistakes as an excuse for indifference or inaction. And let's be clear, Mr. Speaker, inaction does not amount to a strategy for our security or for the Syrian people. But inaction is a choice. I believe it's the wrong choice. We face a clear threat. We've listened to our allies. We've taken legal advice. We have a unanimous United Nations resolution.
The Prime Minister's attempt to brand those who plan to vote against the government as terrorist sympathisers both demeans the office of the Prime Minister and, I believe, undermines the seriousness of the deliberations we're having today. If the Prime Minister now wants to apologise for those remarks, I'd be happy to give way to him to do so.
David Cameron and Jeremy Corbyn there. Now, a vote will be held later tonight, and if the government gets the go-ahead, extra aircraft will be deployed immediately to RAF Akrotiri in Cyprus, and the bombing campaign will be ramped up against IS. Let us begin with you, Tim. This to me seems like a very British way, or a very un-British way, of doing a very British debate. British insofar as we are discussing conflict and military action, but un-British in the way that people are standing up and expressing personal angst over the decisions that they're trying to make.
That's because it's about much more than Syria. It's also about the internal politics of the United Kingdom at the moment, which is why it's got so personal. There's been those intemperate remarks by the British Prime Minister. I actually don't think this story should be anywhere near as big as it is. What is happening is that the vote will almost certainly go through. Within 2 or 3 days, the 8 British fighter jets, which currently bomb in Iraq and have flown hundreds and hundreds of sorties against Islamic State, there'll be another 8 of them, and some of them will sometimes bomb IS in Syria. This is a little course correction for the RAF. This is not a big deal. What is so big about it? And they just join a coalition of 63 countries. They have special kit. It's pretty useful for the allies to use. But it's not that big a military move. But what's going on is in the UK, you have the Labour Party tearing itself apart, and the Conservatives are making hay with that. And so when the Prime Minister of this country talks about terrorist sympathisers, what he means is Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the opposition, and a few people around him. It was intemperate. I don't think he should have said it, but that's what he meant. He didn't mean that everybody that's going to vote against airstrikes is a terrorist sympathiser. He meant you really don't want to get in bed with the likes of the leader of the opposition.
I think it was very, I mean, I think it was a very, it wasn't a mistake. I think it was very calculated, because immediately...
You don't say that kind of stuff if you're the Prime Minister, do you?
Really? Well, because the response to it...
The
response to it was a million social media pictures of Jeremy Corbyn with leaders of the IRA, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's... You know, he threw that in there and then stood back.
That's what I mean about being, it's about it's not about Syria, it's about British policy. I mean, your international listeners all over the world, you know, think, what is this odd little island having this odd little fight? But they are fighting about the 1970s and the IRA. They're fighting about the Iraq War. They're fighting about Afghanistan. I mean, it's all about an internal. It's got very nasty and very vicious. Mr. Corbyn does agree with the aims and the strategies and sometimes the behaviour of Hamas and of Hezbollah, which are regarded as terrorist organisations. He calls them his friends. Consequently, the Prime Minister put that barb in. But it was in a private meeting, but obviously it was going to leak.
You mentioned that this is not necessarily about what is really happening. It's a sort of a navel-gazing exercise to examine the state of British politics now, Tim. That struck me as well, insofar as there's an awful lot of talk about security and the fact that it is just a strip in the sand, the border between Iraq and Syria, Islamic State or Daesh, as they are being called now. Don't pay any heed to that line. There is very little mention, though, of Assad himself in the debate. It's something that people don't really want to get into, although it is being argued that that, in fact, is the whole reason why there has been hesitation.
That's been parked. Nevertheless,
why has it been parked?
Because they're going to get to it pretty soon. Because Putin has changed the game. The brilliance of Putin was coming in and ensuring that Assad cannot lose. If Assad cannot lose, eventually the Free Syrian Army commanders will get it through their heads. Hang on a minute, that means that we can't win. Now, nobody can actually win. But if Assad can't lose, they can't win. Consequently, they might listen to the great powers through the Vienna process and they might come to the table. If you're a real optimist, maybe there'll be peace within about 15, 16 months and only another 40 or 50,000 dead people. And Assad, again, what Putin has done has made it plain that he's forced some of the other powers to accept Assad can stay on for a limited period while they try to get stability and not do an Iraq implosion, but that he can be moved out of the way. The pieces are being put into place right now.
I mean, listening to that, it was mentioned about the idea of Assad being part of this long-term exit strategy. How much does anybody, Daniela, believe that this is actually going to happen if IS/Daesh are removed? If there are those 70,000 moderate fighters on the ground, which no one had found until David Cameron mentioned them, I mean, how much do people believe that Assad will be gone in 2 years?
I don't think people do. I think David Cameron damaged his credibility rather a lot to talk about the 70,000 moderate fighters. We're talking about numbers here. You know, they can fall in any manner of ways. You have the way people are fighting in Syria, you have coalitions, and the coalitions also include people that we are not reliable allies for us. And in any case, where reliable allies, you would have the same strategic aims, which we don't share. The Assad has defied all predictions to stay in place over the last for more than 4 years. There have been times when he's wobbled, and his predictions of that they will become an Islamist monster, much more dangerous and frightening than him, have come true. And I think people have lost sight of the fact that most Syrians are fleeing Assad's bombing, not Islamic State. But the fact is, he's not presenting a direct threat to us. And in an incredibly complicated situation, it's kind of comforting, I think, for many people to think, well, better I can't really swear, can I? But better the devil that we know, better our devil as he's seen.
Putin doesn't care about Assad. Putin will throw him under the bus the moment the bus comes around the corner that he likes
the
look of.
The moment the bus doesn't make him enough money or wield enough influence.
He'll tap him on the shoulder and say, right, off. Either go to Moscow or to Tehran. Both of those cities representing countries which have not signed up to the Hague Convention. Therefore, you can't go and lift him out of, say, Moscow and put him in on trial in The Hague. So, and that would be something that they would quietly agree. Everybody would agree, all right, we won't come after him. So when you can put the pieces into place and get the big peace conference, and then it collapses, all right, we'll hold another one in 3 months' time, and that collapses, all right, we'll hold. And eventually, when they're all exhausted murdering each other, there'll be a peace deal, and Assad can then go away.
The fact that we are discussing this in terms of this, you know, the long-term strategy, the 2-3-4 year plan, none of this is being mentioned in the Commons this afternoon. No. What does that say about the way that the British government operates at the moment?
I think we're still traumatised by Iraq. and Afghanistan and Libya to a certain extent. And people are, I think people are showing more nuance now. And I think this is why they're talking in a very personal, emotional way, because it really isn't the same in so many ways. And even to the casual observer, what's going on in Syria is not comparable to the situation that Iraq was in 2003. But it's been more than a decade of military involvement, and people are battle weary. Constituents are battle weary.
It's why in the motion that's put before the British Parliament, it explicitly says there will not be combat troops in operations on the ground. Explicit, because if there was any chance of that, it wouldn't pass because of Iraq, because of Afghanistan. So they've made it crystal clear. Now, there's a bit of wiggle room there. You could have a special operations squad that went in to try and rescue a pilot if a British pilot went down. That might be within those terms. But the British are not voting tonight to put combat troops in. They're only voting for about another 8 aircraft to operate 100 miles away from where they're already operating.
We had a slight reflection of this a little while ago with our accusations that British pilots are flying over Syria.
Some British pilots were seconded to the United States Air Force in secret. Parliament was not told about this. Under various international laws, as they were seconded to that military, they were then working for that military.
They were effectively American troops.
You know, it was a little bit underhand of the British to do that, to fly British pilots flying missions over Syria without telling the British Parliament.
I mean, what is at stake here is that fundamentally we, Britain, are about to get involved in the Syrian conflict. And the you know, Sykes-Picot, lines in sand, etc., etc., etc. But this is a departure. This is in stark contrast to November 2013, when Labour scotched the proposal to strike Assad after his gas attacks. We are on the verge of getting involved in Syria. And this is symbolic. I mean, as Tim said, our military is not an enormous force, and there won't be boots on the ground. But still, this step is about to be taken.
It's about Britain's place in the world, that might not be a good idea for decision making, but it is about standing shoulder to shoulder with the French, Britain's place in the world, all that, which you can agree or disagree with.
This is what's been brought up quite a few times in the comments, and I think Margaret Beckett mentioned the fact that had the situation been reversed in terms of, let's say, for example, an attack had taken place in London and the French were suddenly deciding whether they wanted to participate in airstrikes, it would seem absurd, it would seem unfair and strange. Yet one thing that keeps coming up in the debate is that there is a huge absence of a long-term strategy. Again, the Iraq, Helmand, Libya, all being thrown up in the argument the whole time. And it begs the question, to what degree do we live in a country, or are we speaking from a country now, which doesn't recognise the concept of long-term international foreign policy?
Correct.
Is the short answer. No, look, I mean...
Well, hang on, sorry. No, okay. The politicians have got 4 to 5 year cycles and they don't think ahead. The civil servants do, but then the politicians get in the way.
Who does then? Because, I mean, if you were sitting...
The civil service and the defence.
No, I'm thinking in other places across the world. Are we thinking...
The Chinese.
The Chinese think. The Americans, the Germans... The Germans, to a certain degree, and they are watching this debate today and are still absolutely unconvinced. They were saying that, I mean, they were watching the British debate and saying actually the mandate is necessary and according to international law. There's a sort of a long-term thinking here on the part of other countries, isn't there, that the British can't get round? Or are we still going back to the Iraq argument again?
Well, I mean, if you look at Iraq and Afghanistan, the short-term focus of the war, the short-term aims were achieved in about 5 minutes. You know, unseating Saddam, severing the link between Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban. That was done and dusted. Military aims were achieved very quickly. But in both cases, perhaps more so in Iraq, because there was some structure of a society to deal with, it was the process that happened afterwards. But I think lessons can be learnt from that. I mean, de-Ba'athification was such a disaster in Iraq. No one is proposing any similar process now, not least because half of the IS leadership is from, drawn from those ranks.
We shall stay in broadly within the subject now as the UK-British Commons head towards a vote in about, what, 4 or 5 hours' time. I think we can expect bombing to begin not long after that. We'll move now to a war of words within the remit of the struggle against IS, but of course between Russia and Turkey. The shooting down of a Russian last week prompted immediate and decisive action by Moscow. Sanctions, travel restrictions, and now accusations that Turkey is buying oil from Islamic State. Daniela, this is a tragedy that's turning into something internationally absurd.
With the shooting down of
the shooting down, and then the war of words between Russia accusing Turkey of buying oil from Islamic State.
Well, I mean, it's perfectly plausible. I think, as I just said, you know, much of the senior leadership of Islamic State drawn from the Ba'athist regime, and for decades there was intense smuggling of oil through sanctions and so on. There are the networks are there now. It's a bit of a step from there to say, as Putin did, that Erdogan's family is directly involved in it. But yeah, sure, smuggling goes on. It's a long border. The ties are there. Smuggling goes on all over the place. Assad is reported to be buying lots of oil from Islamic State. I mean, the price of oil has dropped now. It's a bit less attractive, but they can sell it very cheaply. And there is this whole dark economy of oil going on. So, I mean, Erdogan was pretty decisive. He said, "I will resign if any links are proven." So I think, I think the Russians are not really going to be able to produce a paper trail. They're very good at making accusations.
Tim Marshall, foreign affairs expert, what are your thoughts on this battle of egos between two men, which seems to be a really healthy distraction? I mean, IS must be laughing at this.
Well, battle of egos between two countries that have got a long history. You know, they're close to each other and they've fought each other perhaps 7 times in the last 500 years. They're not about to fight each other again now, thankfully. It was interesting when the jet went down, there was the war of words, but both sides are sophisticated. They know that you can growl at a certain level, and beyond that, there's things you shouldn't do or say. And so they've both been growling at each other, but they can understand each other's growls because they growl in diplomatic speak. And then came the sanctions. And again, they both understand each other's signals and languages. Putin has not gone for the big weapon, which is energy. So Turkey will continue to have 60% of its energy coming from Russia. The majority of its wheat it'll buy from Russia. 30% of its coal it will buy from Russia. That's not a relationship which you want to upset and go to war with.
Although the Turkish have now said that they're going to cut the amount they get.
They're going to cut, over a period of time, just some of the LNG, which is a small part of their energy. And LNG, there's a lot of it, liquid natural gas, a lot of it about. And the Americans, of course, are saying, "Oh, we've got lots of that. We'll sell you that." This is all still positioning. Now, at times like this, it's extremely important to get your positioning and your signalling and your language right, because if you don't, you go to war by accident. But they're not going to war. But Turkey has been rising for 2 or 3 decades now, and you know, they have a long history with Russia, and they're bound to bump up against each other. But sorry, about the oil, very briefly, if it comes out of an IS area, goes to a Kurdish criminal gang, who then change the paperwork and put it some different tankers, who then take it across into Turkey, who change the papers, some criminal there changes. By the time it might end up somewhere in the Turkish system, and Erdogan's son is the energy minister, I believe, by that time, yeah, maybe he's got his fingers slightly black and sticky, but I don't think that means that the Turkish state is buying IS oil.
Daniela, Tim there said that he believed that the position, the signalling and the language is correct in the way that the two countries are growling at each other. But surely they lack a very fundamental part of international diplomacy, and that is perspective. They seem to be entirely unaware of what is happening around them in the rest of the world. And the fact that, you know, if they were to be sensible, as the United States have stressed in the last 24 hours, they would stop rowing and they would actually start to think, how do they deal with the bigger problems in the region?
But they're also, image is very important to both countries. And when the plane was shot down in the initial hours, it was all World War III predictions on social media and so on, and some very, very strong words. And then it became clear that that wasn't going to happen, as much as it became clear that the Turks had just basically decided that they were going to do this. What Russia is doing now, it's made the gestures, and it's also exacting quite a human toll in terms of restrictions on travel, in terms of there's many, many Turkish people who live in Russia. So they're making life hard, and that is the way, and that's reported. You know, it's a very human story. So it seems as it has an enormous impact of Turkish vegetables off Russian shelves.
And they found a case of salmonella in Turkish chicken. They found it 2 days after that plane was shot down. What a coincidence.
It's dreadful.
Chicken's off the menu.
Unless, like, Georgian wine was all of a sudden found to be contaminated.
It was a dreadful thing with Georgian wine. It did very, very bad things to the economy. I mean, very briefly, we're going to go into a break in a minute, but Tim, just looking at the way that Turkey is trying to position itself at the moment, what does all this brouhaha do for its potential entry into the EU?
Well, that's a related subject, which is about refugees and immigrants, migrants. Basically, the European Union has said, we will give you €3 million. You will stop this flow coming over to our shores. In the meantime, we'll do two things for you. We'll give you visas for your 80 million Turks to visit the Schengen area of Europe. And secondly, we will reopen the accession talks for joining the European Union. Now, Erdogan knows we don't mean it. And the European Union knows we don't mean it, but it does. It looks good in Turkey that Erdogan has placed them in a position where the talks about joining the European Union are now back on, even if everyone really knows they're not going to go anywhere.
You're listening to Midori House here with Emma Nelson, Tim Marshall and Daniela Pelled. Coming up next, Der Spiegel cuts jobs and builds a paywall. What's happening to the great German media tradition?
There's a new Monocle book weighing in at 400 pages that's packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. It's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs and a few scuff marks. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, Tim Marshall and Daniela Pelled. Now, keine Scheu vor Konsequenzen, no fear of the consequences. It's one of the slogans on a bag you can buy at the headquarters of Der Spiegel. Der Spiegel breaks big stories, such as claims that bribes were paid to help Germany secure the 2006 World Cup. Well, the German Weekly, perhaps, represents the country's strong media tradition like no other. But it seems that even Der Spiegel isn't immune to the stresses of drops in income. The parent company, Spiegel Verlag, is to cut costs. Jobs are at risk. The paywall is going up. Daniela, how much does this... At what point, I was wondering, do you say, OK, I will go behind the paywall? Surely Der Spiegel is one of those publications where you say, yeah, I'm going to shell out my money.
Well, I would think so. But I think as a profession, as media and journalists have singularly failed to sell the idea that you have to pay for quality product. We're stuck, the consumers are stuck in this idea, a decades old idea, everything on the internet is going to be free. And that can't be the case. I mean, I write for Haaretz newspaper, an Israeli paper, which I would say this is one of the best sources of information on the region. And that introduced a paywall, not a very expensive one, but people regularly say to me, no, I won't pay for it. Out of principle, I'm not going to pay for access, which really doesn't make sense. You're not going to go to a newsstand and take a newspaper away and say, out of principle, I'm not going to pay for it. And people are also willing to pay for other things they can get free. You know, like, people can stream video illegally, but they will also pay subscriptions. So I think we've really missed a trick here. And this is the big problem, that the idea that we start charging for content is seen as a failure.
I mean, she has got a point there, hasn't she, Tim, that not paying for content is something that has been a grave mistake for such a long time. It's that principled thing about journalists are determined for their information to get through. And it is such an admirable and an irresistible concept. But how much do you think we should be paying for something like Der Spiegel, given the fact that it does break stories, perhaps like no other weekly. And you go on their website today, they have an exclusive interview with Ashraf Ghani. And quite hilariously, they have a discussion as to whether Michael Bloomberg is ruining Bloomberg because of his paywall policy. It's quite, there's a big schadenfreude moment happening.
It's one of the great publications of the world. 870,000 copies. I mean, that's... I'm surprised...
It's huge.
Yeah, I'm surprised that therefore they are having to cut so much, because with that sort of circulation, you usually can make some sort of money. But they're clearly going for the different model. You might know that the Sun newspaper in this country, the tabloid, went completely behind a paywall for about 2 years. Then it's come out partially from behind it. Now, I pay, I think it's £6 a month, like €7.50, $10 a month for the Times, which I get on my iPad. I also get, excuse me, a physical copy for that as well. They give you little tokens, paper tokens, to exchange at the newsagents, because I still like the physical copy as well. I think I'm prepared to pay that £5, £6. It's about right to me. But I do have this thing that 9 times out of 10, I won't go behind a paywall. I won't go through the paywall. And there's a bigger problem here, that the state publishers, for example, the BBC, now, if they're not going to go behind a paywall, that's funded by taxpayers' money. Consequently, every time anyone goes behind a paywall, the BBC gets another click and gets a bigger audience.
I think a good model is to have a partial paywall, because there are many publications like the New York Times, you know, you can have 10, 20, 30, or how many a month, and that keeps readers engaged with you, and that provides some access.
Well, interesting. The FT has just changed its model. The FT was very successful. It said, if you click here and register, you will get 5 free articles a month. And that was really successful. A lot of people were looking at 5 articles, and some of them obviously then subscribing for the full thing. That went on for a couple of years successfully, but not quite successfully enough. And the FT changed a few months ago, that instead, I tell you what, as a come on, give me a dollar, you can have the thing for a whole month. And a lot of people thought, oh, a dollar. And then they get used to it and you think, oh, okay. Well, now it's $5. Hey, that's all right.
That's
because
fine.
Because once you've got the habit...
It's not a lot of money.
It's about the habit.
It's like the Hertz first hits free.
Yeah.
Absolutely, the first
and even
free,
even better value.
Yeah. I mean, it is one of those things that sort of struck me between the eyes when I thought, my goodness, Der Spiegel is going to have to shrink in terms of the editorial number on the floor. To what degree, Danielle, is there any concern that a smaller newsroom loses its power?
Well, you know, this happens, but I think our demise as an industry has been, you know, over predicted. People have been heralding the end of print journalism, since radio, probably when they first introduced carrier pigeons, they were saying, well, we're going to lose something very important in our structure. We have to adapt. I mean, it's not about print version. The idea, the system of subscribing where you get a print version and internet access is, I mean, sorry to say this, but it caters for a certain generation, because not sure that many people under the age of 25 have ever picked up a newspaper, let alone paid for one.
And I must admit, I was with a group of people about 25 years old last week, and I asked them the last time they read a newspaper, and they looked at me as if I'd arrived from Mars. And furthermore, what really worried me is that they all worked in marketing and PR, and none of them consulted the news at all. It seems to be, there seems to be a generation increasing who actually actively shun it.
Well, there's a different, but they absorb and they consume news in a different way, and they rely much more on social media. And if you use it judiciously, there really isn't anything wrong with that, especially, you know, for Syria, for instance. I would look to my Twitter feed for more information than I would, you know, in the British newspapers.
Finally, Tim, you mentioned as we were going to air that there is actually a new publication appearing, well, a republication appearing in the German media, or in the German book world, in the next couple of months.
I'm glad you brought that up. My book, Prisoners of Geography, is published in German this month. Did I tell you that?
It's another book.
Oh, the other book. Right, the other book that's being published in Germany soon has nothing to do with me, but Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler is to be published. It was banned for many decades. The difference is this time that there will be text inside Mein Kampf challenging some of his odd views.
Daniela, we have but 30 seconds. You mentioned the fact that Mein Kampf is coming back into Germany, yet travel to various parts of the world and it is not necessarily a bestseller, but you can get hold of it quite an easy
absolutely.
Copy.
Absolutely. It's a cliche. You go to all the Arab capitals and there it is. Publish it. Publish away. I hear it's a very, very dull book.
I've got a copy. I've read it because I think you need to know your enemy. It's The Rantings of a Madman.
Oh, but a strange thing that the Germans should decide to bring it back now.
Well, I agree with you, with Daniela. It is a historical piece. It is there, and I don't think it should be banned. I quite like this idea of putting little comments in it. I know I did when I read it.
Well, rude drawings, maybe.
Tim Marshall and Daniela Pellid will have to leave it there. That's all we have time for today's show. My thanks to my producer, Carlotta Rebello, Fernanda Augusta Pacheco and Antonia Metzhoiser and Chad Chilvers too. Bill Lutie's up next to bring you Monocle's international playlist. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.